This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our final plenary talk just happened, and I've caught up with a speaker, which is Professor Carlos Frank of the University of Durham. And he's been talking about simulations of the large-scale universe, and in particular, looking at the models of cold dark matter and warm dark matter. First of all, do you think you could just explain about what the standard cosmological model is?
Well, we have one of the great success stories of astronomy of the last 30 years has been the development of what has now become the standard model of cosmology called the Lambda CDM model, where Lambda stands for Einstein's cosmological constant, no less, okay. And CDM stands for cold dark matter. So in this standard model of cosmology, the universe or the gravity in the universe is overwhelmingly produced by exotic particles called cold dark matter particles that are very different from the particles that make normal atoms, of the particles that we and stars and planets are made of. These are very different. They are probably produced very early on in the history of the universe, and they are elementary particles that go the wrong way and produce the gravity in the universe. So that's the cold dark matter. The lambda stands for cosmological constant, or more generally for dark energy, and that is a component that of the universe that actually makes up the lion's share of the universe. Cold dark matter is probably only about 20% or so. This cosmological constant, or dark energy, is about 70%, and ordinary matter, the one that we know and love, makes only about 5% of what the universe contains. So this dark energy is responsible for the overall behavior of the universe, and in particular for the fact that our universe seems to be expanding at an ever-accelerating rate. That is almost certainly a consequence of the dark energy, which is pushing our universe, opposing the force of gravity that would, of course, try to make our universe slow down. The dark energy makes it expand faster and faster and faster, and that's what it does. So those are the three key ingredients of this model of cosmology: dark energy, dark matter, and a sprinkling of ordinary matter. And there is, however, another important part of the model, and that is the initial conditions for the formation of galaxies and other structures. All too good to know very well. We know what the universe is made of, but why are there galaxies in the universe? Why isn't the universe just a completely amorphous soup of dark matter in an accelerating universe with a sprinkling of atoms and so on? The reason for that, we believe, in the standard model, very soon after the universe came into existence, about a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang, the universe underwent a fairly traumatic but very short-lived period where small cracks appeared, what physicists call quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. These are just fluctuations that appear driven by subatomic quantum phenomena. The point is that these fluctuations cause small irregularities or cracks in the early universe to appear, and the amazing proposition in the standard model of cosmology is that these small quantum fluctuations are amplified by the gravity of the dark matter, eventually giving rise to the amazing galaxies that we see in the universe today. So it's an amazing story, one that if Newton walked through the door, he'll probably cause Newton to become apoplectic, if not to have a heart attack. He'll say, even Einstein probably wouldn't like this very much, because they would say, what? Are you trying to tell me that galaxies like the Milky Way with a billion stars started life as a quantum fluctuation of the vacuum, amplified by some dark matter that we don't even know exists? You must be out of your mind. The key thing, though, and the reason that distinguishes this model and makes it science and not fantasy, is that, like every good part of physics, it makes predictions that are testable. All right, so you can come up in physics with any crazy idea you want. So long as you can test it and, in principle, rule it out, then you're doing physics. If it's not testable, then you're doing something else, but not physics. And this Lambda CDM model is testable, and it has been tested in great rigor and with very elegant experiments.
Yeah, one of the things you were talking about was how successful it had been in predicting things, and some of the results really were quite stunning. I mean, you explained how There was a theoretical prediction of what the cosmic microwave background sort of looks like, or the scale of its structure. And then that came well before the actual measurement, but the measurement agreed incredibly well.
Yes, now that is really astonishing. So we know the Big Bang, we call it the hot Big Bang, because it was hot at early times. And this radiation, the early heat of the Big Bang, has been propagating throughout the 13.7 billion years that our universe has been around. And it's still around today, but now it's so cold because it's expanded so much that this heat appears now in the form of microwaves. Now, these microwaves were discovered in 1966, in one of the pinnacles, highlights of physics of the 20th century. And 40 years later, it was studied in enough detail for physicists to realize that there was an imprint in this heat left over from the Big Bang of those very same quantum fluctuations that Lambda CDM predicts. And this imprint shows up as small differences in the temperature of this radiation from one place to another. Very, very tiny differences. Remember, these are quantum fluctuations. Quantum are small things. So these are tiny little differences. For the one part in 100,000 in this temperature of the radiation, it was measured in 1993 by the COBE satellite. Again, another important milestone in cosmology, because it gave us direct evidence that this idea that structure in the universe was seeded by this exotic subatomic phenomena occurring close to the Big Bang was not only not completely crazy and wild, but actually agreed with the evidence from this microwave background.
So it was like the patchiness, essentially, of the radiation.
The patchiness, yes. The radiation that comes to us from the Big Bang is not completely uniform. Its temperature is not the same everywhere. It's slightly different from one place to another. It's patchy. And I think many people will have seen these maps of that temperature. When the first map was produced in 1993, which, by the way, won the Nobel Prize in Physics to the person who made this map, called George Smoot, he referred to this pattern as almost like looking at the face of God, because imprinted in the little patches was the whole beginning of the universe. So, yes, so what is really remarkable is that with subsequent satellites, COBE discovered them, but these patches, but then they were measured with great accuracy 10 years later by the WMAP satellite. The amazing thing is that the details of these patches were actually predicted using the standard model of cosmology in the 1980s. And so that, I think, to me, is one of the most remarkable successes of physics, not just cosmology, ever. The fact that physicists working with this a priori crazy model made a prediction for the detailed structure of these hot and cold spots in the microwave background radiation. 10 years later, they were measured, and it was exactly as the theorists had predicted. And the predictions are not trivial. The details that can be measured are exactly what the doctor ordered, exactly what the theory predicts. So it is wonderful to see in astrophysics and in cosmology that we can actually test these very fundamental ideas about the beginning of our universe and its evolution.
So it seemed like a happy ending for that particular model, but you were explaining in your talk that, in fact, the all is not entirely well with the theory of cold dark matter.
Well, yes. I mean, the theory of cold dark matter is a very general theory, and it accounts for not only the microwave background radiation, but also for why galaxies look the way they do. It can tell us in a very compelling way why some galaxies are swirling disks of gas and stars, whereas others are elliptical galaxies. It tells us why galaxies are distributed in space the way they are. So it has many, many feathers to its cap. However, when we examine some of the more detailed predictions of this theory, now on scales of very small galaxies, what are called dwarf galaxies, in particular satellites orbiting around the Milky Way, then something seems to be perhaps not quite right with the theory. In the following sense, though, the successes of the theory are there and are not going to go away. The question then is whether the assumption that the dark matter is cold is actually correct in detail, or whether it's a different kind of particle, what physicists call warm dark matter.
What does temperature or coldness and warmth actually mean for dark matter?
Yes, physicists loosely refer to these different types of particles by a temperature, cold and warm. All they're talking about, physicists in this context, is the fact that when these particles were produced in the very early universe, they were not at rest, they were moving. Cold particles are very sluggish particles that move very, very slowly, hence the name cold. Hot dark matter would be particles that move very, very fast, and warm dark matter are intermediate, move at intermediate velocities. So the names cold, warm, hot really refer to the size of these primordial velocities that these particles had when they were formed. Now, it turns out that the universe might have made cold particles, sluggish, very heavy particles, or it might have made particles that moved a little bit more, in which case they would be warm. And the two are very similar from the point of view of cosmology, very different from the point of view of particle physicists, particularly of particle physicists trying to discover these particles or detect them. It makes a huge difference whether it's a cold particle or a warm particle because they interact in different ways with detectors and so on. However, from the point of view of cosmology, the differences are really relatively minor and manifest themselves only when you look in detail at the structure of these dwarf galaxies. There you expect to see differences, but on larger scales, it doesn't make any difference if it's cold or warm. It's just that until now, we've all focused on cold because it was the simplest hypothesis to try. And now it seems to be this hypothesis perhaps breaking down on the scales of dwarfs. Well, not completely broken, by the way. There are ways out, but there seem to be problems that could be maybe a sign that actually the particle is not really a cold particle. It's actually a warm particle. But this is a difference of detail. The success of the standard model remains regardless of this detail of whether the particles are cold or warm. So it's a very important detail for physicists, but for cosmologists, it's just a detail. I think the success of the microwave background radiation, the success in understanding the evolution, formation, evolution of galaxies and the spatial distribution, they are there no matter whether the dark matter is cold or warm. But if you're trying to find one of these, then it is very important that you know, because you would make a completely different experiment. For example, if the dark matter is a cold particle, then, in principle, the Large Hadron Collider, the big particle accelerator in Geneva, should be able to make particles in the laboratory, make dark matter in the laboratory, if it is a cold particle. And that is because, the publicity advertised, the Large Hadron Collider will recreate the conditions that prevailed in the universe when it was a millionth of a second old. And this is exactly the time when the cold particles would have been manufactured in the real universe. So if the Large Hadron Collider can copy the Big Bang, particularly if it can recreate the conditions a millionth of a second after the Big Bang, it should be able to make the same thing as the Big Bang made, namely cold dark matter. However, if the dark matter is not cold, but warm, then there's no hope. The LHC won't be able to recreate the conditions required for making warm dark matter. So if in the next 2 years we haven't woken up to the Today program telling us that the Large Hadron Collider has made dark matter, then I think we should begin to take even more seriously the possibility that it is a different kind of particle, possibly a warm dark matter particle. From the point of view of the success of cosmology, say it's a detail. From the point of view of experimental physics, it's a fundamentally different proposition.
Okay. And you've been involved in quite a number of simulations, starting with the conditions of dark matter and then showing how the universe should develop. It seems amazing to try and simulate the universe in a computer, but I gather that's where you get some of the predictions from, that you're able to then test against observations.
Oh, yes, no, it is pretty amazing. And my job description says, Professor Frank, Institute of Computational Cosmology, Durham University, your job is to make universes to order. And that's my job description. And indeed, another of the remarkable achievements of physicists of the last 20 years has been the ability to make virtual universes in a computer. So what we do, in principle, simple, in practice, a bit more complicated, but in principle, is disarmingly simple. So here's what we do. We know about the initial conditions, these quantum fluctuations I was talking about before. And then we make a hypothesis for the dark matter, cold dark matter, warm dark matter, hot dark matter, whatever. And there's the second part. Third, we know the laws of physics. And we assume that the laws of physics that we know about here on Earth, like Newton's law of gravity, or the Boyle's law of gases and so on, the ordinary laws of physics, apply not only here on Earth, but everywhere and at every time. So we program the computer with the equations that describe the laws of physics. We prime it with the initial conditions, with quantum fluctuations. We make a hypothesis about the nature of the dark matter, and we let the computer solve the equations. Away goes the computer. You need a big computer for this, I should add. You need a supercomputer. Off it goes, comes back a few weeks or a few months later, and it's produced a virtual universe. In other words, it solved the equations of physics, telling us what a universe would look like if our hypotheses were correct. So in principle, that's what the real universe would have done. I mean, the real universe has solved the equations of physics, yes, in a manner of speaking, and that's what we do in computers. So the degree of realism with which we can now simulate the universe is really pretty awesome. We are able now in computers to make galaxies that look almost indistinguishable from the Milky Way. Wow. We can make stars. We haven't yet cracked fully, although there are advances here, the problem of making planets, but I think that's just around the corner. Okay. And then once we've been able to make galaxies, stars, and planets, why stop there? I like to simulate a human. I like to simulate the origin of life. And eventually, if I live long enough, I like to simulate the origin of consciousness. Oh. Why not? If a computer can do a galaxy, why not do human consciousness?
Well, you need a computer the size of the universe to simulate the universe, though, in the end.
Well, yes, I mean, the computers, of course, are approximations to the real thing. And what limits the power of a computer is the complexity of the problem. If it turns out that, say, life is a lot more complex than we expect, then it will be very difficult to simulate the origin of life. But we should be optimistic and hope that at least the biochemical processes that gave rise to life should be amenable to computer simulation. I'm not so sure about consciousness. And in a way, it's scary to think that you can simulate consciousness, because if you can, what guarantee is there that there isn't somebody else somewhere else in the universe who's already cracked the problem, and we are nothing other than a computer simulation? Yeah. So I'd rather not think about that.
It sort of stops being a simulation, doesn't it, once you've got a consciousness in the computer?
Yeah.
But, well, coming back to the predictions for galaxies, you were talking about how to distinguish between cold and warm dark matter based on the amount of substructure in galaxies.
Oh, yes.
So the sort of clumpiness of matter within galaxies. And is that something that will be able to be tested with telescopes to try and solve
astronomically? Yes, I mean, it's sort of slightly paradoxical, but these dwarf galaxies, which most people kind of turn cold shoulder and turn their backs to, or turn their noses off at these small galaxies, because they're very small, you know, they can hardly see them. Astronomers weren't really interested in them because they're so hard to observe. Yet, it may be paradoxically that these little dwarf galaxies have the key to the great mystery of the identity of the dark matter. And the reason is that cold dark matter, warm dark matter make identical predictions on the scales of galaxies, galaxy clusters, microwave background radiation, but they make subtly different predictions on the scales of these dwarf galaxies. For example, in the case of warm dark matter, we expect far fewer dwarf galaxies than in the case of cold dark matter. Moreover, we expect the dark matter clumps in which these dwarf galaxies live to be slightly different from the case of cold dark matter. And the interesting thing is that the theory again makes very definitive predictions, which are in principle testable with observations that can be carried out already with the biggest telescopes we have, and it would become routine with the next generation of telescopes. So the big telescopes that are now in the pipeline, like the European Extremely Large Telescope, for instance, which we hope will be built in the next 20 years or so, they will make it routine to measure the properties that need to be measured for the stars in dwarf galaxies to unlock the mystery of the dark matter. So it is there. Mm-hmm. So the mystery is there. We have the key. It's in the dwarf galaxies. We just need to be able to put the key in the lock. And that operation will require a next generation of large telescopes. But it's there. The answer is just there waiting for us to tap it.
Fascinating. Well, the last thing I thought I might ask you about was I went to a session on these simulations, and there were a lot of different ways that people had used to simulate how particles affect each other by gravity. And I thought, well, there's one physics, and yet people come up with many different ways to approximate the physics in the computer. So how does it come that just the one thing results in so many different algorithms for computing it?
Okay, so if you have the same law of physics, then that law is expressed in terms of an equation, a mathematical equation. Now, some of these equations are very complicated because they're not simple algebraic equations that were mathematicians call partial differential equations, nonlinear partial differential equations. Sounds very fancy, and it is very fancy. So solving these equations in a computer is very hard. And it could take a long, long time in a computer. If you don't design an effective and efficient algorithm, it would take you a long time to solve these equations. So the debate there is what is the most accurate, efficient, and clear, simple way of solving these differential equations that describe the laws of physics, which in turn describe, we think, nature. So that's what the debate is. It's a very fascinating sub-area of applied mathematics called numerical mathematics, where one tries to solve these equations using a computer. They cannot be solved in the traditional analytical way because the equations are too complex. But that's why you were at a session with people. Possibly I wasn't at that session, but I've been in sessions like that, bragging as to who has the best way to solve these equations. And it is important because to be able to do a realistic simulation, of course, one needs to be able to solve the equations as accurately and as efficiently as possible. As it is, we already use, for the simulations I was talking about today, one of the largest supercomputers in Europe. And we have to monopolize that supercomputer for months at a time, to the extreme annoyance of chemists and other physicists who also want to use the computer. Luckily, we are doing a very appealing and sexy problem, which is the structure of the universe. But so having efficient algorithms is absolutely vital. And actually, and that's the reason why, combined with the power and amazing technological developments in computer technology, that the subject has taken off the way it has. It's not just the technology, it's not just quicker computers, more computers, cheaper computers, but it's also the mathematics behind it that has made this explosion possible.
So is that why you want to simulate a consciousness? Because maybe that will then create the best algorithm for doing a dark matter
that's
simulation.
Right. You could get a computer, that's right, to program itself. We already do that at some level. Yeah. We already get the computers to design the algorithms to solve higher level, more complicated problems. So we already see how that can happen. So my great fear is that we will one day make a computer so powerful that it'll be able to unlock the mysteries of the universe. And my fear is that I'll go to the computer and I will say to the computer, well, tell me, please, what is the answer? And the computer will talk to me and say, look, you asked me to solve the problem. I've solved it, but I can't explain it to you. You're not smart enough to understand. This is my biggest fear.
All right, well, I think we better let you go and catch your train. So thank you very much for talking to us.